From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. When I was a preteen, there was nothing I looked forward to more than watching a double feature at the Alex Theater in Glendale with a tall bucket of popcorn nestled in my lap. Maybe it's because of that movies and food have always been a natural pair in my mind. Today, I wanted to look at a few movies where food actually plays a starring role on the screen.
The most and the only thing we can expect out of life is to be present with the ones that we love in the moment that we have.
That's Lulu Wang, the director of The Farewell, which opens in theaters nationwide this weekend. The movie's loosely based on her real-life experience of going back to China when she learned her grandmother was diagnosed with lung cancer. Her family made the decision to not tell her grandmother about her diagnosis. Instead, they planned an impromptu wedding as an excuse to say goodbye. It's a heartbreaking story, full of subtle moments and, of course, food. Lulu Wang joins us to discuss the family drama at the heart of The Farewell and the power of food to bring us together when words won't do. Welcome.
Thank you.
When you set out to make the movie, was food at the front of your mind as a storytelling device?
It was, but not in the way that you would necessarily expect. You know, I think that normally when we see a film, a story about an Asian American family, food is always at the forefront of the culture because it's an expression of love. But in my film, because the family is grieving, the one thing that they've lost is their appetite because they're not at a celebration. So they don't really want to eat. But because grandma has gathered the family under the guise of a wedding and a celebration, she continues to feed everybody. And it surprises her when somebody in the family doesn't want to eat or seems to be sort of almost disgusted by the food. And I really wanted to use food in this way to sort of visualize the internal tension that the family is facing, that, you know, the one way they can express love back to Nai Nai, grandma, is by eating her food. But how do you do that when you're grieving and you don't have an appetite?
When you're grieving and you can't show that you're grieving.
Exactly.
Too, because that makes it even harder because the moment doesn't pass.
Exactly.
One of the conflicts in this movie that's so interesting between East and West is the tension between Billy's family who immigrated to the U.S. and their relatives who stayed in China. How did you experience that conflict in your own life and how did it inform the story that you wanted to tell?
Well, you know, I think that I've always had to negotiate between my American identity and my Chinese identity. You know, in America, in some ways, I'm never American enough because of the way I look. And in China, I will never really understand or fully be Chinese enough. And yet there's an expectation that I should be, right? Even though I've left, they're like, there's a lot of these reminders, well, you are Chinese and you must respect and honor your roots. And even in making the film, when I told my parents about it, my mother would say, how can you make this film? You don't understand China. And it's almost like, well, then do I not have a story? Am I not allowed my perspective, which is admittedly one that lacks a bit of understanding? And is that my fault, you know? But I wasn't raised there. I came to this country when I was 6. And my parents raised me in a way to be very assimilated so that I would feel at home in America with American culture.
And like Billy's uncle says to her at one point in the movie, pulls her aside and says, look, the fact that we've decided to keep the truth from your grandmother has to do with our culture, which is different than the culture you grew up in, which is individual.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is more about society, history, family.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I found so interesting was in the first scene that we see the family all together in Nai Nai's apartment in China, everyone's cooking. And even though people don't necessarily want to eat, that act of preparation and engagement is a way for people to be next to each other, allow all the dynamic that happens within families to play out
mm-hmm.
in the scene without even really eating. And it's where you see Billy for the first time start to have to kind of parse her own feelings about what's going to unfold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it was very much an introductory scene to this family. It's why we shot it the way we did, where, you know, everybody's isolated in frames, in the frame, we're over the shoulders of the other family members. You don't see who they're sitting next to. Everybody is covered except for the the one person that we're introducing. And you kind of see where grandma's state of mind is. She's very excited to be preparing this wedding. She's excited for this reunion. And where everybody else's state of mind is. They're, you know, privately, silently grieving.
So who chose the food that would be in some of those scenes? It's interesting because often in movies that dwell with family drama, but also have a lot of food within the scenes, the food is idealized. The food mm-hmm. almost becomes a character.
Exactly.
But in your movie, the food is, it's very realistic.
Yeah. And that was important to me, that I wanted the food and the eating to be part of the texture of the family, of life, and not above it, not romanticized, not idealized, and not made to be food porn, because I think that's a very American thing to suddenly, oh, we've discovered food culture, so now we're all foodies. And in these ancient cultures, nobody is a foodie and nobody's a non-foodie. Everybody just eats food and good food, you know? And it's especially in middle class or lower, even lower income families in the villages, out in the farms, people don't have a lot of access to really high quality food, and meat is very expensive. So they really just, you know, value every little bit that they can get, and it's the thing that brings the family together. It's the thing that brings joy to the family. Yeah, so I'm glad that you said that. It was important for me to make it realistic and not, you know, do these like solo close-up shots on it as a way to sort of elevate or romanticize it in any way.
And I often think that that also sometimes takes away from the story. It's like, let's have this interlude where it's just about the food. One of the most interesting for me moments in the movie to watch was when Billy goes with her family to leave offerings at her grandfather's grave. And the family that has remained and is still very tied to tradition is yelling out instructions to the family that is more removed from traditions about what to do.
Yeah.
Like, you put the oranges down. No, you're supposed to peel the oranges. And at the beginning, it seems so chaotic mm-hmm. and disparate. But as you pan back from them and you see them as a group going through this, it's clear how unified they are.
Yes. You know, what I was trying to say with that scene and with showing these rituals is that in a way, it's more for the living than it is for the dead. These rituals are a way that brings the family together, that unites them. And no one really has the answers as to what is the right way, because, you know, China's a very, very large country, first and foremost. So even while we were shooting that scene, I was talking to the art department and the crew about, okay, how we were going to approach the scene and what we should actually put down first. And the crew started arguing. The crew started going, well, in my family, you know, you got to put the pears first, because pears have this specific meaning. And if you put that later, then it's a curse. And then other people said, no, but you have to put the napkin, and we always put the fruit later, and we burn the incense first. And so everyone started arguing. I said, guys, that's the point of the scene, is that there is no one way. We don't have to figure this out, you know, and you're actually proving the point of the scene. And they kind of all looked at me and they were like, yeah, okay, but I still think that you should, you know. I just went back into it and I was like, all right, whatever, you guys can figure it out. I don't care how it's done.
Very, very powerful and funny at mm-hmm. the same time. And also it helped chart Billy's sort of journey between being so resistant to the lie and then coming to some kind of peace.
Yeah.
Did that happen with you?
Yeah, I think so. I think that I came to peace, not necessarily with the lie itself, but just more with, you know, the fact that there are multiple truths, that there are lots of different ways of doing things, and we can all coexist, you know, and ultimately it's not about right or wrong. It's about the time that we can spend together, and hopefully in as truthful, as honest a way as possible without talking about the one elephant in the room, can we still have a really joyful and honest moment as a family? And in some ways, like that experience, that wedding, that goodbye was more meaningful than any other we've ever had, you know, any other reunion, because everyone saw how ephemeral it is and that it could be the last time. And so I think that everyone was really present in that moment.
Okay, so this is kind of a silly question, but I'm curious. During a group photo, everyone is instructed to say eggplant.
Mm-hmm.
What's the Mandarin word for eggplant, and is it a common photo op directive?
It is. It's the cheese of China.
So say it. I want to see your mouth smile.
Okay, it's 茄子. So I love that they say eggplant, because I think both that the eggplant is in the shape of a smile, but also when you say it, 茄子, it makes your mouth smile.
Where are your recommendations to get some of the dishes in here in LA that are featured in the film?
Okay, I just have to tell you, this was a huge drama.
Why?
When I was told that I had to find restaurants, because honestly, I don't know, right? And so, you know, I'll go out to San Gabriel Valley when my family's in town or my parents take me, but I just follow them. I go where they take me. I never know what the name of the restaurant is. And I don't take that many trips out there on my own because I'm busy. And my brother and I, once in a while, will go, but a lot of the restaurants we've been to have closed. So I called my mother before getting here, and we got in a fight. I said, Mom, can you please, like, help me? Because if I look in English, I'm not going to find the good ones. Can you Google it in Chinese? And she says, well, I don't live in LA. Let me call, you know, my friend who lives in LA. And she goes, you call my friend who lives in LA. I said, I don't want to call your friend. You call your friend. I got to get to the station in like 10 minutes. Also, she's going to tell me the Chinese name, but I don't know Chinese, so I don't know how to say that on the radio. So you need to tell her, get the Chinese name, plug it into the Chinese internet, and then find me the English name. And we fought about this for a good 10 minutes.
Hashtag parents.
Hashtag parents, hashtag, like, you know, I think that any, you know, second generation or very, like, young age coming over first generation immigrant like myself will understand this, is that, you know, I'm as clueless as any other American.
So while you're looking this up, I love that you have your phone out.
She sent me a few.
Okay.
Yeah.
We should explain that there's this one great moment where Nai Nai uses her strength to go out to the banquet hall where the wedding is going to be held. And it's a way of exercising her control and her vigor still. And she gets in a fight with the hotel management and the chef, saying that she was promised lobster. And they're like, no, it was crab. It was always crab.
Yes. And that's, you know, when we were shooting that scene, a lot of the Chinese crew were like, ugh, this is such a typical thing to happen, you know, where in order to bait you into making the reservation, they'll tell you one thing, but then you show up and it's this other thing, and you have nowhere to go to complain, and it's too late. And so everyone expressed their frustration, because I guess things like that have happened to them before.
So during the wedding banquet scene, we see platter after platter after platter of whole crabs coming to the table.
Yes. Okay, so you want the restaurants? Okay.
Sure.
So we looked up specifically, I asked her to ask her friend to look up specifically Northern Chinese cuisine to suggest some Northern restaurants that she goes to.
And is this a reference to the meat pies that we see at the beginning of the movie?
You know, I'm not sure. They may serve them, they may not, but like dough products, dumplings, meat pies tend to be their own restaurants, like, because they're so hard to make that a lot of restaurants specialize just in that. I'll just sort of prerequisite and say that I haven't been to these restaurants.
We understand.
Recommendation from my mother's friend who lives in San Gabriel Valley. There's one called Shen Yang Restaurant, S-H-E-N-Y-A-N-G. It is on San Gabriel Boulevard.
And what are we eating there?
It's a specialized in northern Chinese cuisine in the Dongbei, which means northeast region. And so you're going to get a lot of the foods that was in the movie. And another one, also northern Chinese, is simply called Northern Chinese. And it is 8450 East Valley Boulevard in Rosemead.
I love this so much. You have no idea how perfect this is for our audience.
I hope that like lots of white people just show up and be like, I heard this on the radio. Lulu's mother's friend lives around here and said I should come. It'll be an adventure. Please find me on Twitter and tell me how it goes. That would be very exciting for me.
So funny. So what's next for you? Are you going to continue to mine your life for story ideas?
Yeah, always. I mean, I think that everything I make is an exploration of a personal question that I have about humanity, about relationships, about family. And they tend to be questions that I don't have an answer to and probably will never find an answer to. But, you know, my films are a way for me to at least explore those questions. So I am, you know, you'll be interested in this. I am working on a TV series about my brother's life, and he is a chef and he works in Los Angeles, and he dropped out of school when he was 19. To my parents' dismay, to become a chef. And now he is a very successful sous chef at the age of 25. He's the sous chef of Auburn in Los Angeles on Melrose.
I'm the emoji with the head blowing off.
Yeah, and he's never cooked. He doesn't cook Chinese food.
He cooks that.
You know, like it's like a very elevated tasting menu, California French cuisine. But I think eventually he wants to open his own restaurant. So if there's any investors out there, hit us up. His name is Anthony Wong. He's amazing. The show is going to be called Family Meal, which is the meal that the entire restaurant staff comes together to eat before the start of dinner service.
Oh, we can't wait.
You can also visit him at Auburn. He says he's had people come visit him. I wrote him out of the movie, but people, like, we did this New York Times piece and people read it, and so they show up at his restaurant to talk to him about the movie. It's amazing.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much, Lulu.
Thank you.
I've been talking with director Lulu Wong about her film, The Farewell, which opens nationwide this weekend. To learn more about the restaurant she mentioned, visit kcrw.com/goodfood. In a moment, we turn to a documentary about a couple who left city life behind to try and farm 200 acres of barren land just outside of Los Angeles. Stay with us. We're back on KCRW's Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and we've been looking at some new movies where food plays a starring role.
You're scarred, but you're also deeply rooted into, you know, what nature's language is, which is way different than ours.
That's Emmy Award-winning filmmaker John Chester. Some years back, he and his partner Molly were evicted from their Santa Monica apartment. So they did what we all dream of, pack up their life and set out to become sustainable farmers. They ended up on a defunct avocado ranch in the foothills of Ventura County, 200 acres of land as dead as can be. The first time I stepped foot onto Apricot Lane Farm, it was early on in the project, and yet it felt ripe with possibility. On my second visit, it was as if I'd stepped into some kind of agricultural energy field, with life pulsing all around me. It was stepping into the pages of E.B. White's Charlotte's Web, with frolicking animals, avocado groves, and stone fruit orchards. And all of it just an hour northwest of Los Angeles in Moore Park, what you might think of as SoCal suburbia. The Biggest Little Farm is a documentary about the transformation of Apricot Lane Farm. I'm joined by John and Molly Chester now to talk about their 8-year journey and the making of the film. And I am so happy to have you both here.
Aw, we're so happy to be here.
Yeah, so glad that we've been on this journey together in a way.
I feel so lucky to have watched the transformation from pretty early on. And I'm so grateful that you made this film, because people seem to think that it's like a magic wand. Let's talk about Molly's insane enthusiasm and how that pushed you to begin the project.
Yeah. So my journey came from in my 20s, my health declined a bit. I was a vegetarian. I like to say I was kind of an unhealthy vegetarian. I didn't know how to do it properly. It was lots of soy dogs and soy crumbles and things like that. And I landed myself really behind the eight ball. And to correct that, I started really connecting how what I ate changed how I felt. And from there, it became a passion that became culinary school. And as I went deeper into what is nutrition and how really to get the body to absorb that nutrition, it became first about the health of your own gut and understanding diversity within that. But then it became about the choices a farmer makes, because you can do all sorts of things in the kitchen to maximize nutrient density with soaking and sprouting and fermenting. But then it really is that you have to start with something nutritious. So as I started sourcing food for our clients and going to see farmers and meat farmers, we couldn't find the type of eggs that we wanted, and our dog would not stop barking. So the combo of those two things led us to pursue trying to find a farm, and here we are.
So this farm, from the very beginning, was very ambitious. It's a lot of acreage. It required a huge investment. And for that, you turned to investors.
Mm-hmm. And we had to really align with someone that already saw the future in food as not just going back to food that had great depth of flavor, but food that was nutrient dense and that flavor was informed by the health of the soil. And the bonus was doing it in an ecologically enhancing way where you're regenerating the land versus just the extractive methods that we've become so used to over the last 75 years.
So one of the most fascinating parts of the film is it's almost organized in a call and response fashion where there's like a problem and then panic.
Yeah.
And then calm and then a solution that is still within the context of this very natural system, this eight that you're trying to create, not just in the soil, but throughout the entire ecosystem. So let's talk about some of those really difficult things. I mean, first of all, the soil, the difference in the soil between when you first got it and how many years in?
Eight.
Yeah.
It's insane. I mean, it's a dirt clod versus something that you could just stick your arm into.
Yeah. Right.
How hopeful, right?
Yeah. I mean, it took 45 years of extractive farming to destroy that soil, but it only took 7 to 8 years of conscious farming to rebuild it to better than what it was. And that's a lot. I think that gives a lot of hope.
Your sort of guru on this journey was this extraordinary man, Alan York, who's known for biodynamic farming, which some people kind of poo-poo, but
yeah,
the basic thread of it is this soil building.
Yeah.
Yeah. We look at organic farming, but not many people really understand there's no requirement for organic farming to rebuild and regenerate soil. So whether you call it biodynamic, regenerative, or holistic, even permaculture, all these methods now, the common agreement is if you don't have soil regenerating techniques, then you're not really doing anything new for the land or for the food that you're growing.
What really struck me in the film is how willing the two of you were to go along on Alan's ride.
Willing? We didn't show some of the stuff that was happening at night.
The fights.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was so, yeah, he spoke in very, at the time, I thought flowery terms. But now when I watch it, I'm like, oh my gosh, I understand everything he was saying. And it took 8 years for me to get to the point where I understood it. But yeah, we kind of had to go because he basically was like, you can't have a foot in both sides of the circle. You need to really go deep. And the one thing that we learned is that there's so much humiliation and embarrassment in the failure. But what we learned with Alan and sometimes without is that you had to go deep into that humiliation and embarrassment before you made an attempt at a solution, because you had to understand the problem so deeply. But normally, because of that humiliation and embarrassment, you want to turn away, turn around and fix the problem, but it's very short-sighted.
Yeah.
Give me an example.
Well, yeah, gophers. I would say,
Morning Glory.
All right, so the first thing we did is we grew cover crop in order to build soil. Well, that created the worst gopher problem in Ventura County. In fact, if we can sell gopher meat, we would be the richest farmers in the world right now. So we had the worst gopher problem started because we tried to help the soil.
Is that because the roots dangling down?
They love clover. They love roots. The tender roots of grass are their favorite. And the second choice is the roots of our orchard trees. So the immediate reaction of most common sense farmer would be get rid of the cover crop. It's doing nothing but causing problems. But we stayed with it. And we learned two things. One, gophers don't attack roots that are older of older orchard trees. So as the trees got older, they were less susceptible to the gopher damage. But the other thing was, we started realizing there are all these things within our farm that were going to start to come and solve that problem. Barn owls, they eat, you know, anywhere from 20 to 40,000 gophers off our farm a year. Badgers, weasels, gopher snakes, all these things started showing up. But it wasn't like in a year they showed up. It was over the period of 5 years. So we had to go and stick with it long enough to allow the ecosystem to respond. And it just doesn't do it on the timeline that our human capacity for patience really understands.
Let's talk about the chickens, because your first huge success from a commercial and consumer standpoint are the eggs. I mean, here in Southern California, Apricot Lane eggs are famous. Wherever they go, they sell out in minutes. And those eggs happened because?
We did a 5-year study on the nutrient quality of the eggs. And over the 5 years, you know, vitamin A levels went up, lutein went up, omega-3 to omega-6 ratio went up. We were feeding them the same supplemental feed. The only thing that changed over that 5-year period was what? The health of the soil.
Bugs.
Right. The health of the bugs living in that soil and the grass growing from that soil. So once we figured out that and we were able to, you know, collect that data, of course that's going to translate to most anything else on the farm.
So the sort of showpiece of the farm are the orchards. How many different varieties did Alan make you plant?
We have 75 different varieties of fruit trees in that block. And now the purpose of it is to put them in, figure out what works and doesn't. We wanted to maximize flavor. So we knew that we would be heading towards product lines because you don't have a lot of shelf life for that. And then from there, we would graft over things that weren't working to things that were. And so we've started that process, but you have to be very patient to figure out what works because it takes many years.
Predators are another factor of farm life. And you say in some cases, observation followed by creativity became your greatest ally. In other circumstances, you had to question your approach, like the coyotes. That was brutal. I mean, you had these beautiful animals.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big turning point in the story because we had coyotes that killed 350 chickens, and this ideology that we were going to live in harmony with nature. I mean, we looked ridiculous and were not very popular among our team because they were like, how could you let one coyote live and 350 chickens die? But there's this amazing moment that happens in the film where we sort of draw this conclusion and we do end up solving the coyote problem, but sort of not in the way you might think. And there is a purpose to the coyote. The coyote is also eating gophers and rabbits. And we literally can watch our rabbit population go up. And then 6 weeks later, the population goes down and you hear the coyotes running through the farm at night. And coyotes are also pollinators of, you know, any animal that moves across the landscape is a native pollinator. So you start to begin to develop this awareness for these things, but it creates this, it's not about right and wrong in farming. It all becomes this sort of experience of consequences and how long you can last in the game, because consequences will tell you the truth, but sometimes it takes longer, and that's your right and wrong. And so that story is very important in the film.
And then we should just say, as a place to go visit, it's this lovely bucolic sort of moment in Southern California landscape, animal husbandry, botany, agriculture, climate, bird migration, the eggs. And I was so happy to see when you walked in, you handed me a bag and there's a product from the fruit.
Yeah, I know. It only took us 8 years to get there. But we do. We have a bourbon lemon marmalade. It's our very first. It uses whole cane sugar, so sucanat, and then a biodynamic evaporated cane sugar. And our lemons and some journeyman bourbon, and it's really delicious. And avocado oil. So we press with our Hass avocados, and that is a wonderful oil because it has a super high cooking temperature. So you can grill. It's a stable at room temperature with a liquid oil that you can also go super high with, and it's kind of uncommon and buttery and good.
So how can people visit the farm?
Well, we do tours, so right now we're doing about once a month, and you want to log on to Apricot Lane Farms and sign up to receive the notifications, because that's how you get the first word that there is a tour, because right now they are selling out pretty quickly.
We announced the first tour recently. The website got hit by 36,000 people at the same time, and it crashed the site. And then when its site came back up, we sold 400 tickets in 10 minutes. So we are trying to catch up, so be patient. It's so crazy, the enthusiasm.
So let's talk about the film. Where can people watch it?
Well, I know it's still playing in some theaters here. It's been out for almost 10 weeks now, but I know in Southern California it's still playing in a few theaters. And then it'll be available for streaming and DVD here towards the end of August.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Evan.
Thanks so much.
That's John and Molly Chester of Apricot Lane Farm. We've been talking about The Biggest Little Farm, the film that John directed about their journey. It's playing a limited run in theaters throughout LA. After the break, we turn to a documentary that was the most awarded film at Sundance this year. My interview with the filmmakers behind Honeyland when we return. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Picture a woman living in a remote settlement at the edge of the world. She makes her home amidst ancient ruins, soaring rock faces, and arid valleys. In her world, there are no cell phones, no internet. Her elderly mother is failing and half blind. To help them survive, she cultivates honey from wild bees using methods as old as humans. If any of this sounds like a fiction, well, it's not. It's real, and it's been documented in stunning detail in Honeyland, the most awarded film at this year's Sundance Festival. Today, I'm joined by the pair behind Honeyland, Tamara Kotevska and Lyubomir Stefanov. Hi, how are the two of you?
Hi, good, thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks for inviting us.
And congratulations. You know, when it first starts to spool out in front of you, you're thinking that you're watching one of the most incredible National Geographic style documentaries ever. But then it starts to morph. It takes place in the mountains of Macedonia. What can you tell us about the people who live in that region and about that region?
Well, this is a very interesting region. Like on the sides of the river Bregalnica, because this river changes its natural flow every more than 10 years, let's say. And with this, the complete civilizations and cultures around this river and in this area change also. And it's interesting that you can find on the same place artifacts and evidence from the Romans to the Second World War to Turks, to many, many different civilizations. Atice is one of the last remaining inhabitants from the tribe Kazalbashi, which is an old Turkish tribe. And they're not much different from the culture or the religion. But what makes her specifically different and how she lives her life is specifically the wild bee hunting and in the rule that never gets broken, which is different from all the other people in the area and how they keep their bees. And this rule is the most important rule that we apply to in the film, which is take half, but leave half to the bees. And this refers to all nature. Everything that nature gives us as a resource, we must be aware to take half, but leave the other half to the nature so it can revive itself.
Could you describe the kind of beekeeping that she practices? I mean, some of the most incredible parts of the movie are all the shots where she's really close, she's unprotected, and it's very intimate. She sings to them, she talks to them. It's like they're her children.
I don't know how many. It's not a big number of people who are hunting wild bees, but there are also other people. And first, actually, we found her brothers. They moved from the village a long time ago, and they have families, they have children, grandchildren. And they're also hunting wild bees, and taking wild honey, but in a very different way. What we saw when we find her, it was that exotic relationships between her and the bees, and that singing, that communications with the bees.
It's
unique. We can't explain that.
It's like the ancient world lives in the now.
Probably something like that.
I understand that you ended up following her for a long time, 3 years.
Yeah.
What were some of the challenges in doing that? Did you go back like every month, every 4 times a year? What was your rhythm with her?
Well, we tried to go, we usually went every weekend. I mean, this was later when we met the other family, because the children were coming to Bekirlia when they didn't have school. So it's for the weekends and all the summer, let's say. And before that, with Atija, we went maybe 3 days a week.
Before we meet the other family, which is a whole other part of the film, whole other part of the story. I mean, she's just, as a person, as a character, she's incredible. You have this woman who dresses in traditional dress. And when she goes to Skopje, the capital city, to sell her honey, you would think that she would navigate like a country, what we would call a country bumpkin, somebody who was very naive. But in fact, she completely holds her own. She's very smart.
She's very sharp.
Very funny.
And although she don't have even primary education, she's speaking 4 languages fluently. 4 different groups of languages. She speaks Turkish, Macedonian, she speaks, which is Slavic language, she speaks Albanian, which is isolate, and she speaks Roman fluently.
I mean, you managed to find a singular person. It's very rare in this
world.
We're
aware of that.
Very rare.
Maybe it's not that rare, but you need to look more carefully, and people are very ignorant these days. So
it's true. One of the things that makes this movie so fascinating is how it turns when the family comes next door. You think you're watching one story, and then all of a sudden, all of these themes erupt out of the conflict between her and this family, and it almost seems like it's scripted. There's some times where you're watching this and you're like, this cannot be a documentary.
But when you see the scenes, when they're so real.
This is a compliment, actually. Thank you.
I mean, because you had no idea that these people are going to show up. And so right there in this tiny space, there's going to be a conflict between modernity and the ancient world.
These people, when they showed up, we ignored them for a while because we didn't find them necessary, let's say, in the story. We were focused on Atija. And as she started opening more to us, she told us about all the conflicts that they have. It's not only with the bees, they have other conflicts. And that's the moment when we decided we must find a way to approach these people because they're a crucial part of her life. And we decided to stick just with this conflict, just with the bees, because this was what we needed for the story.
She must have seen the film. She saw the film.
Yes,
she did.
And what did she think?
She liked it.
She loves seeing herself telling the story. The first time when we came there, she said, it was my dream that one day some journalist came and shoot me while I was walking on the hills. So she doesn't make a difference between journalists and TV crew and film crew. But she thinks that she is the one who found us, not vice versa. So she was a part of this very strongly, and she loved being out there with people, out with her story. And when the premiere happened in Macedonia, after the premiere there was a party, she came and she grabbed the microphone from the band and started singing. And that was one of the best parties that happened in Skopje.
Incredible.
So she enjoys it very much.
I don't want to give away the ending and what happens, because it's the way it unfolds is just extraordinary. Is she still living in the same space on her own?
No. After we went to Sarajevo Film Festival, that was the first festival we attended, with work in progress, with the assembly of materials. It wasn't even first cut. We won the award from Turkish National Television. And it was like 30,000 euros. And with this award, we made sure to buy a house for her in the next village that has basic living conditions, because this is what she wanted after the death of her mother. And now she's moving back and forth between the new house, where she's close to her relatives, and the old one.
You know, she has a choice now.
I'm so happy. Is she still cultivating bees?
Yes.
She is. Okay, that makes me feel good. And in fact, I have a tiny little jar of honey here. Okay, I'm going to taste this honey.
Sure.
Oh, it's delicious. What are the flowers?
I can't say.
Mountain flowers. We're supposed to have... I'm just kidding.
It's very interesting with this honey that every time it tastes completely different.
Depending on the vegetation.
The season and the flowers around.
Wow. This is something very precious. Thank you.
You're welcome.
As is this film you made. Really something very, very special. Congratulations.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with filmmakers Tamara Kotevska and Lyubomir Stefanov. Their film is Honeyland, and it's in theaters now. Really, go see it. Now we turn to something that's especially sweet this time of year. Jillian Ferguson is at the Santa Monica Farmers Market with more.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. We are back at the Santa Monica Market this week celebrating the return of a very special fruit, the green gage plum. And here to tell us all about it is David Karp. David is a journalist who's been writing about fruit for almost 3 decades. It's literally his job to travel the world and find the most spectacular fruit there is. And a few years ago, he decided to try his hand at farming and partnered with stone fruit specialist Andy Mariani to bring the fruit of Andy's orchard here to the Santa Monica Farmers Market on Wednesday. David, you are holding what I believe is a bag of green gage plums. Tell us what makes this fruit so special.
Well, they're not actually, even though they look like green gages and thereby hangs a tale. But what's special about the green gage is it's a small, green, unprepossessing plum native to the Caucasus regions, the subcaucasus. And it was brought to Italy in the 15th or 16th century and thence to France, named after the wife of King Henry, Queen Claude, whence it's called in France the Reine Claude. So it's most famously grown in France and Europe. In France, it's grown on some 5,000 acres. And the French are passionate about it. Why? Because even though it doesn't look very good, once you bite into it, it's twice as sweet as normal plums with a rich, complex, intense, captivating flavor. So I first encountered the green gage when I was 7 years old and going to public school in England in 1965. And my jaw dropped. I just couldn't believe how it was emblematic of the very different culture, different to a 7-year-old boy. So it's sweet. It's got a fair bit of counterbalancing acidity, a very pleasant texture that melts in the mouth, and the very distinctive aromatics that nobody's really fully studied, and I'm hoping to do a scientific article on that with an expert in that field this year, because Andy and I have a bumper crop, which we'll be bringing to the Santa Monica Wednesday only Farmers Market for 2 weeks, probably August 7th and the 14th of this year. Green gages were previously grown commercially on a significant scale in California a century ago and used for canning. I've got a pretty good collection of antique green gage labels. But with the advent of Asian plums, which are more productive, larger in fruit size, but not nearly as flavorful, green gages faded. And when I first researched them some 20-something years ago, there were no commercial growers in California. The New York Times sent me to southwestern France, to Tarn-et-Garonne, for 10 days of can you believe it? They actually sent me there. That'll never happen again. That was a plum assignment to research green gages for a feature article that appeared in the New York Times in 2004. And I learned how to grow them. Andy Mariani, who's the patron saint of specialty stone fruit, had a tree in his yard, so he had the gene pool to grow them. It was just a matter of figuring out how and planting the orchards. We've very rarely had a good crop because it's a finicky fruit. They require a lot of coddling, and they require a lot of winter chill, which we get less and less of here in California. But Andy's been playing around figuring out what horticultural practices to use, and, well, knock on wood, I don't want to jinx myself by saying, but he may have discovered a few things. Anyway, this year, finally, we have a good crop. They're alternate bearing, so probably next year they won't be quite as good a crop.
You mentioned that there were none grown in California before you took up this project with Andy. Does that mean that you were the only people growing greengage plums in the state of California?
Well, it depends. There are other people that have, you know, 10 or 20 trees, but we've got 3 or 4 acres, which is a totally different class. But there are a lot of people who have these fruits that I'm holding in this bag right here. Now, tell me what you think this is. Let's describe this to listeners. These are golden, yellow, green orbs with a little bit of blush.
Mm-hmm. Yes. It looks a little bit like a greengage plum.
It looks a little bit, anybody that really knows the fruit, it's completely, yes, please, bite into it. Bending over so that the juice
doesn't is not getting all over me.
What can you say about the nature? I'm going to eat one myself.
I would say the skin is very, very tart.
And that is never the case with a true greengage. The texture is waterier. It's not nearly as sweet. So this is an Asian greengage. Very often, I mean, at least half a dozen times, I've been called to what I was told was a greengage orchard in the San Joaquin Valley. And from usually from 100 yards or more away, I just start laughing. Snookered again, because I can tell from the growing habit and the color, those are just Asian gages. I mean, you can call them greengages if you want, the same way that I can call you Shaquille O'Neal. But you're not, are you? That doesn't make it so. So, but the way that the customer can tell is bite into it. If it's not super sweet and if there's any hint of tartness next to the stone and the skin, that's an Asian plum and it ain't no greengage.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you, Jillian. It's always a pleasure.
Always. That was David Karp, the fruit detective. You can find David and his bumper crop of greengage plums at the Andy's Orchard Stand at the Wednesday Santa Monica Farmers Market for the next couple weeks. I'm talking now with Diane Ng, who is the pastry chef behind the gorgeous desserts at Auburn in Hollywood. And Diane, I know you're a fan of the elusive greengage plum. How are you incorporating them into the menu at Auburn?
So we have lacto-fermented plums right now that are going with our strawberries and milk dessert.
Okay, so first things first, what is lacto-fermentation? How do you lacto-ferment a plum?
There's several ways you can lacto-ferment fruit. The technique we use is adding salt to it. So we take the greengage plums and we do a 2% salt with it, and then we let it sit at room temp for about 30 days. So lacto-fermenting is the process where the lactose sugar from the fruit turns into lactic acid.
Okay, so you said 2% salt by weight. If we were to do this at home, that means we would take our plums home, cut them up, weigh them, figure out how many grams we had, figure out what 2% of the weight is in salt, and then we just add that salt directly to the plums?
Yeah, you don't even have to cut up the plums. Just rinse them and then weigh them, add your salt, throw them in an airtight jar, and then just let it hang out.
I have to tell you, I have tried this at home before, and every time that I do it, my ferment bubbles over. Is that a problem?
Do you add liquid to it?
No, I don't add liquid, but I do press down the plums to release some of their juices. Should I not be doing that?
No, that's fine, but you actually, it bubbles because you have to, what we call burp them, so you have to release some of the gases, so open up the container, release some of the gases, and then close it up again.
Okay. And so we just let it sit at room temperature for 30 days.
Yeah, or until you're satisfied with the taste. It could be 3 weeks, it could be longer than 30 days. It depends what you're looking for.
And then once they've completed their fermentation, how do you add them to the strawberries and cream?
So we puree them, and then we pass it through a fine strainer. And then we just put the paste in a piping bag, and that's it. And then we take the leftover skins that didn't make it through the strainer, and we dry that and turn it into a powder and mix it with strawberry powder as well. So that gets dusted on top of the dessert, so nothing gets wasted.
Wow, okay. And how long does it keep once you've made that paste?
The last batch I did was 3 years ago. I mean, I have some at the restaurant at Auburn. There's probably 170 pounds of plums fermenting away right now. But the last batch I made was a few years ago. I have a little bit for you here. I brought you some to taste.
Oh, my gosh.
I want you to taste it with strawberries. I think it's really amazing.
Okay, so you've just brought over a strawberry, and you are squeezing onto it some of this lacto-fermented
greengage plums from
and,
like 3 years ago.
And this is from 3 years ago.
Yeah.
All right.
These plums are from New Zealand.
Oh, wow. Okay. Let's give it a shot. Oh, wow. It almost tastes like caramel.
It's good, right?
It's incredible.
Mm-hmm. It's like a richness in flavor.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
strawberries are already perfect by itself, but just adding this just kind of takes it into a different direction. It makes it interesting. Does.
Yeah. And such a great way of saving the season because greengages only last for a couple weeks. So.
Yeah. Yeah.
Amazing. Well, Diane, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
That was Diane Ng. She is the pastry chef at Auburn, a beautiful restaurant in a storied address. Used to be home to Michelle Richard Citrus and Hatfields. It's on Melrose in Hollywood. Check it out. For The Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
After the break, we close out with a new restaurant review from LA Times restaurant critic Patricia Escarcega. Stay with us. Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleinman. Finally, Patricia Escarcega joins us with a new restaurant review. Hi, Patricia.
Hi, Evan.
Where are we headed?
We're headed up to Altadena. We're going to a little gelateria called Bulgarini, and it's run by a gelato master called Leo Bulgarini.
Famously Jonathan's favorite gelato in Los Angeles. I've worked with them several times for catering jobs, and my most incredible Bulgarini story is the time that he made me four different pear gelato, each one a different pear variety.
Ooh, yes. Yeah, I think last time I went, he was doing the four pears as well, and it's just incredible the amount of labor that goes into his gelatos is astounding, and you can really taste the difference.
But we're not here to talk about gelato.
No, we're not. We're here to talk about pasta.
Which is so surprising and yet not.
That's right. I spent a couple of hours having dinner in his restaurant, and I was very fortunate in that I caught him on kind of a slow night. So I really got to talk to him for about 2 to 3 hours on a Sunday night. And he said he started adding pasta regularly to the menu about a year ago. And so he does a really, I call it a pleasantly eccentric kind of pasta slash wine slash gelato tasting menu.
Which is sort of extraordinary. So you get to choose your adventure.
That's right.
Depending upon how much food you want to eat. But let's talk about the pastas that he's serving. I think the most surprising for me is the peachy alla Lione.
Ah, yes. That's actually was my favorite one. Usually when you come in for dinner, you can see one of his apprentices rolling it in the back of the room.
Basically, it's individually hand-rolled spaghetti.
That's right. And it's kind of
labor-intensive.
Labor-intensive, comes with a really simple, I would say, really, really good tomato garlic sauce.
And the toothsomeness of the pasta and the porosity because of that hand rolling makes it really extraordinary.
Yes, you really get like a really nice, definite chew out of it, which is one of my favorite things about pasta.
What other pasta dishes does he offer?
He has a really good pappardelle. He does a great spaghettini. And he serves it in a lemon butter sauce.
That sounds incredible.
Yeah, it's very, again, very simple, but full of flavor. Other chefs might be a little bit more, just a little bit more temperate with the citrus. But he goes full bore on it, and it really pays off.
Speaking of boar.
Yes, he has a great wild boar ragu that he serves. He calls it his signature dish, and the flavors are kind of subtle, but it kind of reminded me of like a really good homemade pot roast, just really earthy. And he cooks it for more than a day. So it's really, really soft and tender.
So how are the meals composed?
A lot of the meal at Bulgarini, and I think the appeal of it is that it really kind of, you have to go with the flow. It's a one-man operation. The sequence of the meal kind of goes according to Bulgarini's mood that night. The dishes themselves are composed very simply. You get one course, pasta course, and in between, he courses out the gelato. And he does a very curious gelato plus wine tasting. And this is where you realize that Bulgarini is a trained sommelier. So he really loves that artistry and science of picking flavors and pairing them together.
The way you described the room itself seemed very synchronous with this kind of extremely personal food experience.
Definitely, Evan. When you have dinner with Bulgarini, it doesn't feel like you're at a restaurant. You feel a little bit like you've penetrated someone's inner sanctum. And in this case, it's his kitchen workshop. So you're sitting at these high tables and you're surrounded by kitchen equipment. So I think while other restaurants would hide all those things from their guests, he really just lets it all show.
Can you order a la carte?
Yes, you can. You can certainly order a la carte. I've seen people do it. Here's my pro tip for visiting Bulgarini. Please make a reservation. I happened to be in the area, so I dropped by one night and had a few dishes a la carte. But it was a little distressing for him because he only makes a small quantity every day.
And then what are the levels of composed meals?
So you could do the a la carte. The plates average around $20-something dollars. You could do the $45 dinner special. You get two pasta dishes and you get a gelato. You could do the $75 four-course sampler, and that changes, so depending on what he has available. And if you call and reserve ahead, you know, you can get a clear idea of what you'll be eating. And then there's the top-tier dinner, which is the chef's table, and that runs about $150. Again, that might vary depending on what he has that night, but that was about a five-course dinner in terms of pasta, and then there's four gelatos in between.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, Patricia.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me, Evan.
That was Patricia Escarcega, restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times. That's it for our show this week. If you missed any of it, as always, you can listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. And as always, if you like the show, please leave us a review. My thanks to the Good Food team. They are Nick Liao, Laurel Garcia, Joel Stein, Joseph Stone, and Ronnie Mickelson. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kenny Ng, and Paola Mardo. I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with a new episode of Good Food.